Hello, welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, September 14th. I'm your reader, Dagna. We'll begin today with the mini editorial, which is written by Richard Sater of Sioux City. And Richard writes, in response to the mini editorial on Sunday, the writer says his voting rights are restricted. Are you a legal American citizen with legal identification? If so, please go vote. Again, this was written by Richard Satter of Sioux City. We'll begin with a story concerning COVID, and the headline is, federal judge temporarily orders Iowa to allow school mask mandates. A federal judge on Monday ordered the state of Iowa to immediately halt enforcement of a law passed in May that prevents school boards from ordering masks to be worn to help prevent the spread of COVID-19. Judge Robert Pratt said in an order signed Monday that the law substantially increases the risk of several children with health conditions of contracting COVID-19. Several parents and the ARC of Iowa, a group that defends the civil rights of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, sued the state. Pratt said he has looked at data on the effectiveness of masks to reduce spread of the virus and agrees with recommendations from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the American Academy of Pediatrics on mask wearing in schools. Because plaintiffs have shown that Iowa Code Section 280.31's ban on mask mandates in schools substantially increases their risk of contracting the virus that causes COVID-19, and that due to their various medical conditions, they are at an increased risk of severe illness or death, plaintiffs have demonstrated that an irreparable harm exists, he wrote. At their Monday night meeting, the Sioux City Community Board announced it will discuss a mask mandate for the district at an emergency meeting on Wednesday. If we saw an obvious threat involving the safety of our students and staff, we would be remiss if we didn't correct that threat, said school board member Monique Scarlett, who requested the district implement a mandate. The COVID-19 virus, with all of its variants, is a safety hazard the world hasn't seen since 1918. Pratt's order, said Governor Kim Reynolds and Iowa Department of Education Director Ann Liebel, cannot enforce the new law banning local school districts from using their discretion to mandate masks for students, staff, teachers, and visitors. He issued a temporary restraining order to be in effect immediately. It remains in effect until the court issues an order for preliminary injunction. Reynolds released a statement Monday afternoon. Today, a federal judge unilaterally overturned a state law, ignored the decision by elected legislatures, and took away parents' ability to decide what's best for their child, Reynolds said. We will appeal and exercise every legal option we have to uphold state law and defend the rights and liberties afforded to any American citizen protected by our Constitution. Mike Baranek, president of the Iowa State Education Association, described the order as a welcome relief in a statement issued on Monday. He writes, the ISEA maintains the people in the best position to decide what is right for a school district are the people in that school district. The order returns this decision-making to the local level by temporarily lifting the mandate which prohibited action. We support local school districts' ability to make decisions about the health and safety of their school community based on local metrics, needs, and requirements, especially when those decisions protect our most vulnerable students. And then we'll move to a story, related story, headline, Sioux City School Board to consider mask mandate. The Sioux City Community School Board will discuss a mask mandate on Wednesday. Board member Monique Scarlett asked for the district to implement a mask mandate. Scarlett made the motion stating all students, staff, and visitors to be mandated to wear a mask in district buildings. She said wearing a mask has been scientifically proven to be the second best way to reduce the spread of the virus. If we saw an obvious threat involving the safety of our students and staff, we would be remiss if we didn't correct that threat, Scarlett said. The COVID-19 virus, with all its variants, is a safety hazard the world hasn't seen since 1918. The school board will vote on the topic in a special meeting at 3 p.m. on Wednesday. Scarlett wanted the vote to be an emergency item on Monday's meeting, but based on legal guidance, they postponed the vote. Those who know me know I am about peace. I do not relish in any kind of fight, but some fights are worth engaging in, especially when the health of our children are at stake, Scarlett said. On Monday, federal judge Robert Pratt ordering the state of Iowa to immediately halt enforcement of a law passed that prevents school board from ordering masks to be worn to help prevent the spread of COVID-19. Both Scarlett and fellow school board member Taylor Goodvin said they planned to ask for a mask mandate at that meeting before the federal judge decision was released. Scarlett had previously asked the board to consider a mask mandate. Cassie Thompson with Siouxland Public Safety Alliance asked if the school will return to requiring masks on school campuses. She said the organization relies on the school to protect the health and safety of students and staff. In the county, Thompson said vaccination rates are low and test positivity rates are high. As of September 5th, 43.4% of Woodbury County is vaccinated, and the latest weekly positivity rate was 13.2%. Masking, along with other mitigation strategies, is more important than ever, she said. Board President Perla Alicorn Flory said local control has been taken away from schools. She read a draft letter written by various school board members in the area to ask Governor Kim Reynolds to remove the legislation. Our teachers tell us that the best way to teach kids is in the classroom, and that the best way to keep kids in the classroom is to protect their health. We need every tool at our disposal to accomplish that, including the ability to enforce mask mandates. Our next story, headline is Lavender Beer Earns Mardo Brewing Gold. Mardo Brewing Company's Lavender Fields Forever was named the nation's top fruited wood or barrel-aged sour beer during the 2021 Great American Beer Festival Awards Ceremony Friday in Denver. Even before we opened, we were thinking, wouldn't the GABF be the ultimate award to get, Mardo owner Eric Martin said. As a brewer, it's the ultimate thing. Rod Wellman and I were talking. It's not the bronze, it's not the silver, it's the gold. It's pretty crazy thinking that of 101 entries in that category, we win the gold. The Sioux City Brewery, opened for a little over 2 years, was one of 30 breweries to have won medals as first-time entrants in the annual competition, considered one of the top professional brewing contests in the country. The contest is sponsored by the Brewers Association, a nonprofit trade association that represents small and independent craft breweries. Hopefully, as a brewery, it gives us exposure to new consumers. It shows we're legit, Martin said. It builds your reputation. If you become well known as a GABF award winner in certain popular categories, it can just mean a financial boon to the brewery, said Wellman, a brewer. A wild fermented sour beer, maybe not so much, he added with a chuckle. Lavender Fields Forever was brewed and then aged for a year in barrels on blackberries, black currants, and lavender sachets from Los Hills Lavender Farm in Missouri Valley. It was fermented with Saison yeast and, oh boy, Brettanomyces, a wild yeast that adds earthy flavors. Lactobacillus, a bacteria, was added to give Lavender Fields its tangy sour qualities. 250 bottles of the beer were bottled in September 2020 and distributed to members of the brewery's Los Hills Society Club. It is 6.3% alcohol by volume. Due to the unpredictable nature of brewing with the wild yeast and the bacteria, including the possibility of contaminating non-sour beers, combined with lack of brewhouse space and the low popularity of the beer style, the brewery has no immediate plans to produce another batch of the winning beer and has, for the time being, suspended its aged sour program. Technically, it's one of the harder beer styles to pull off properly, Wellman said. Putting into the right barrel, pulling it out at the right time, adding the right amount of fruit, all those different decisions along the way, adding the right bacteria, it's a difficult style to pull off. Someday we'll get to the point where we can experiment and do those beers again, Martin said. He added that despite the hard work, Lavender Fields Forever was a fun and sexy beer to make. Iowa breweries that won medals in the 2021 contest include Single Speed Brewing Company of Waterloo and Cedar Falls, Gold for a Ring Around the Ghosts in the Contemporary Ghosts category, and Bronze for Tip the Calf in the Session Beer category. Pivo Brewery of Kalmar won Gold for Decora Nordic Groot in the Historical Beer category. Peace Tree Brewing of Knoxville got Gold for Get a Little Hazy in the Juicy or Hazy Strong Pale Ale category. Lion Bridge Brewing Company of Cedar Rapids got a silver for the disaster at Mew in the Brown Porter category, and Keg Creek Brewing Company of Glenwood got bronze for Old Marathon Barley Wine in the Wood and Barrel Aged Strong Beer category. In Nebraska, Zipline Brewing Company of Lincoln won a bronze medal in the Dortmunder or German Style Oktoberfest category for its Fest beer. In South Dakota, Lost Cabin Beer Company of Rapid City won bronze for its table beer in the Belgian Style Table Beer or Belgian Style Session Ale category. And Spearfish Brewing Company of Spearfish won a bronze medal in the Imperial Stout category for its beer, Bird Bones. During the competition, 170 judges evaluated 9,680 entries from 2,192 breweries from all 50 states, Washington, D.C., and Puerto Rico, according to a press release from the Brewers Association. The awards ceremony was held as part of the association's Craft Brewers Conference. Despite being forced to cancel the festival portion of the GABF, our brewing community rallied together to make this year's GABF competition one for the books, our largest competition judge to date, said Chris Swerzy, competition director at the Great American Beer Festival. Judges continued to be impressed with the quality and innovation of all entries they evaluated. The Brewers Association is proud to honor this year's deserving winners, and we look forward to celebrating in person together next year. Our next headline is Sioux City Council defers vote on one-year agreement with Gil Holling. The Sioux City Council will wait another week to vote on a one-year agreement extension that the city's solid waste collection has with Gil Holling of Jackson, Nebraska. This deferment was to give City Environmental Services Manager Roger Benz more time to see if the agreement will allow small home improvement businesses or individuals to use the city's landfill by dropping off debris. A guy making home improvements on his property should be able to drop off debris at our landfill instead of making a special trip to Jackson, Mayor Bob Scott said during the Monday meeting. I think we'll need to clarify that before continuing. In a 5-0 vote, the City Council approved a resolution for Gil Holling to eliminate the definitions of non-working holidays and working holidays while clarifying the definition of other holidays. Also on a 5-0 vote, the City Council approved an ordinance to clarify language pertaining to holiday collection in addition to increased landfill fees, charges, and net weight of loads to coincide with the current solid waste agreement. On a 4-1 vote, the City Council approved a $3.84 million proposal from Kosovic and Murphy Developments to build a 24-unit apartment complex at 1720 Morningside Avenue, a city-owned lot. It was chosen over a $3,224,500 proposal for a 24-unit apartment complex by Aftershocks Ventures at the same location. City Council member Alex Waters, the lone dissenter, questioned if students at the nearby Morningside University could afford the rent of the apartments, while Julie Shaner said the slightly smaller units of Kosovic and Murphy's proposal will make the property more economical. Ex-Sioux City plastic surgeon gets probation for fraud. A former Sioux City plastic surgeon has been placed on probation and must pay a fine and restitution for falsifying patient medical records while he practiced in Michigan. Adam Smith had pleaded guilty in a federal court in Michigan in April to one count of making false statements. 6 counts of health care fraud, 10 additional counts of making false statements were dismissed as part of a plea agreement. Under federal sentencing guidelines, Smith could have been sentenced to up to 6 months in prison. U.S. District Judge Harla Jarboe on Friday placed Smith on probation for 3 years, fined him $3,000, and ordered him to pay a $100 assessment and a total of $6,360 in restitution to the Centers for Medicare Services and the Michigan Medicaid program. According to terms of his probation, Smith may not work in any medical field without first informing his probation officer. Smith was indicted in 2019 for actions that took place at his Traverse City, Michigan practice from 2011 to 2014. He was charged with billing cosmetic surgical procedures not covered by Medicare or Medicaid as medically necessary non-cosmetic procedures and falsifying patient records to cover up the billing fraud. Smith practiced in Michigan until 2014, when he moved to Sioux City, where he was affiliated with Tri-State Specialists before leaving the group in fall of 2019. According to court documents, he moved to North Carolina, but it was not clear if he continues to live there. He still could face civil action in Michigan. A complaint filed in federal court in December of 2018 accuses Smith of filing 89 fraudulent Medicare and Medicaid claims totaling more than $64,000 while he practiced there. Proceedings in that case were previously stayed. With his criminal case concluded, either side may ask to reopen the civil case within the next 2 weeks. Smith voluntarily surrendered his Iowa medical license in February to resolve charges of professional incompetency and unethical conduct. The Iowa Medical Board charged him in 2019 with providing inappropriate surgical care to 17 patients and other unprofessional conduct from December 2014 to September 2017. He also surrendered his South Dakota medical license. Smith still faces at least 7 lawsuits in Woodbury County filed by former patients, each of whom alleges that he mishandled their surgeries and/or post-surgical care. A jury found in Smith's favor in a previous lawsuit, and judges have dismissed at least 7 others. Sioux City man gets 12 years prison for shooting. A Sioux City man charged with breaking into a home and shooting a man in the leg was sentenced Friday to 12 years in prison. Christian Morales, 23, pleaded guilty in Woodbury County District Court to willful injury and domestic abuse while assault while using or displaying a dangerous weapon. As part of a plea agreement, charges of first-degree burglary, intimidation with dangerous weapon, and a second count of willful injury were dismissed. Morales broke through a kitchen window at a home in the 800 block of Main Street on November 1st, armed with a handgun. Once inside, he went to a bedroom and fired several shots, one of them hitting a man in the right calf. Morales then pistol-whipped the gunshot victim in the back of the head. After the victim and another man ran from the house, Morales punched and kicked a woman, who is the mother of their young son, in the face before fleeing. He later turned himself into police 12 days later. Wakefield man pleads not guilty in sex abuse case. Ponca, Nebraska. A man accused of sucking on the toes of several children and rubbing his penis on another child's feet has pleaded not guilty to child pornography and numerous other charges. Jose Fregosa, 27, of Wakefield, Nebraska, entered his written plea Wednesday in Dixon County District Court to 3 counts of possession of a visual depiction of sexually explicit conduct, 10 counts of felony child abuse, and 1 count of third-degree sexual assault of a child. Fregosa was arrested July 29th after a Nebraska State Parole investigator observed 3 photos of naked children on Fregosa's phone during a child welfare visit at his home. According to court documents, Fregosa told investigators he did not deliberately acquire the photos. Fregosa told investigators he has a foot fetish and had sucked on the feet of one child who is under age 12 almost every week for about 4 years, and that he had touched his penis to the child's feet approximately once a month for the past 2 years. Investigators found videos on his phone of an adult male rubbing his penis on a child's foot. Fregosa told authorities he sucked on the toes of 9 children when they were sleeping during sleepovers at his house, and that he filmed some of the encounters with 3 of the children, court documents said. Siouxland man sought by Fugitive Task Force. The U.S. Marshals Service Northern Iowa Fugitive Task Force is seeking the following person. Nathaniel Reynolds, 22. He is 5'9" tall and weighs 140 pounds. Reynolds is wanted on a warrant issued in Woodbury County for 2 counts of sexual abuse in the third degree. Anyone with information can contact the U.S. Marshals Service at 712-252-0211 or email siouxlands.mostwanted@usdoj.gov. And then Gabriel Iglesias coming to Tyson Events Center. Stand-up comic Gabriel Fluffly Iglesias will be bringing his act February 5th, 2022 to the Tyson Events at 401 Gordon Drive. One of America's most successful comedians, Iglesias has received almost 1 billion views on YouTube and has more than 25 million fans on social media. In 2018, he was included in the Hollywood Reporter's Top 40 Comedy Players issue, alongside such giants as Jerry Seinfeld, Chris Rock, and Lorna Lorna Michaels. Tickets will go on sale at 10 a.m. Friday at the Prime Bank box office at the Tyson Events Center, online at tysoncenter.com, or by calling 712-279-4850. We now have a couple of Nebraska stories, and the headline for the first one is Nebraska Lawmakers Launch Special Redistricting Session. Nebraska lawmakers launched a special session on Monday to redraw the state's political boundaries, with one proposal that would add a 50th state senator to the legislature to try to keep rural Nebraska from losing a seat. Senator Mark Coulterman of Seward proposed the measure along with two other rural senators. The bill would expand the legislature from its current 49 members to 50, as allowed under the Nebraska Constitution. Adding a senator would reduce the ideal number of residents per legislative district, making it easier for lawmakers to preserve rural districts that lost population over the last decade, while still adding a district to the fast-growing suburban Omaha. The bill's prospects are unclear, and some lawmakers questioned whether they could legally consider it in a special session that is strictly limited to redistricting issues. Lawmakers have asked Nebraska's Attorney General to offer a legal opinion. Even so, rural senators said they plan to press the issue as a way to ease pressure on senators by reducing the average number of residents per district. The measure was co-sponsored by Senators Matt Williams of Gothenburg and John Stinner of Gehrig. "I want to help protect the rural senators of the state," said Coulterman, whose district could be merged with another rural district under one of the proposed plans. "We are still in a rural state. Agriculture drives the economy. Agriculture is the backbone of this state." Speaker of the Legislature Mike Hilger said lawmakers could start first-round debate on redistricting bills as early as Friday. Members of the Redistricting Committee have scheduled public hearings Tuesday in Grand Island, Wednesday in Lincoln, and Thursday in Omaha. The two-week special session could easily turn contentious as Republicans and Democrats work on new political districts in officially nonpartisan legislature. In addition to legislative districts, lawmakers must also approve new boundaries for Nebraska's three congressional districts, the Nebraska Public Service Commission, the courts, the University of Nebraska Board of Regents, and the State Board of Education. Republicans hold a majority, but don't have enough votes to overcome a Democratic-led filibuster as they did during the last redistricting in 2011. That's likely to force lawmakers into some sort of compromise. Nebraska State Senator is first Democrat in governor's race. A Nebraska State Senator and former Bellevue City Council member became the first Democrat to announce a bid for governor on Monday. State Senator Carol Blood promised to try to unite Nebraskans. "I love Nebraska, but I know we can do better," said Blood, who grew up near Hastings. "Our collaborative efforts are much stronger than the voices of a few, and we can build a better Nebraska. We do this by inspiring hope and working to transform our divisions." Blood first won a seat in the officially nonpartisan Nebraska legislature in 2016 by defeating a Republican incumbent in a politically divided Sarpy County district. She overcame a GOP challenger in 2020 to hold on to the seat. But the 60-year-old Blood will face a difficult task getting elected in the GOP-dominated state that former President Donald Trump won by 18 percentage points. In fact, Ben Nelson was the last Democrat to hold statewide office when the moderate served as governor from 1991 to 1999 and as U.S. Senator from 2001 to 2013. Blood said she hopes Nebraskans will realize they have a lot more in common than they differ on, and she hears a lot of people who are sick of divisive political rhetoric. "The only way we're going to fix this is collaborative by nature. We all have to come to the table," Blood told the Associated Press. The field to replace Governor Pete Ricketts, who will be forced from office by term limits, already includes a long list of Republican contenders. Businessman Charles Herbster, who also ran for governor in 2014, and Michael Connelly have both declared, as have State Senator Brett Lindstrom and University of Nebraska Regent Jim Pillen. And former Governor Dave Heineman is considering running for his old job. During her time in the legislature, Blood has focused heavily on veterans issues and election transparency, among other concerns. And now is a COVID related story that isn't necessarily a local story, but it is information that we all need. Experts, shots are working. Scientists say most people don't need the COVID booster yet. The average person doesn't need a COVID-19 booster yet, an international group of scientists, including two top U.S. regulators, wrote Monday in a scientific journal. The experts reviewed studies of the vaccine's performance and concluded the shots are working well despite the extra contagious Delta variant, especially against severe disease. Even in populations with fairly high vaccination rates, the unvaccinated are still the major drivers of transmission at this stage of the pandemic, they concluded. The opinion piece, published in The Lancet, illustrates the intense scientific debate about who needs booster doses and when, a decision the U.S. and other countries are grappling with. After revelations of political meddling in the Trump administration's coronavirus response, President Joe Biden promised to follow the science, but the review raises the question of whether his administration is moving faster than the experts. The authors include two leading vaccine reviewers at the Food and Drug Administration, Drs. Phil Krause and Marion Gruber, who recently announced they will step down this fall. Among the other 16 authors are leading vaccine researchers in the United States, Britain, France, South Africa, and India, plus scientists with the World Health Organization, which already urged a moratorium on boosters until poor countries are better vaccinated. In the United States, the White House has begun planning for boosters this month, if both the FDA and Centers for Disease Control and Prevention agree. Advisors to the FDA will weigh evidence about an extra Pfizer shot Friday at a key public meeting. Colorado Governor Jared Polis on Monday urged the Food and Drug Administration to quickly authorize booster shots for the Pfizer coronavirus vaccine, as well as permit children ages 5 to 11 to be vaccinated. Polis said that foot dragging by U.S. Health officials has cost lives. The FDA needs to get out of their ivory tower and realize there is a real-life pandemic, he said. Georgetown University's Larry Gostin said the paper throws gasoline on the fire in the debate about whether most Americans truly need boosters and whether the White House got ahead of science. It's always a fundamental error of process to make a scientific announcement before the public health agencies have acted, and that's exactly what happened here, said Gostin, a lawyer and public health specialist. The United States already offers an extra dose of the Pfizer or Moderna vaccines to people with severely weakened immune systems. For the general population, the debate is boiling down to whether boosters should be given even though the vaccines are still offering high protection against severe disease, possibly in hopes of blocking milder breakthrough infections among the fully vaccinated. Last week, CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky said new data showed that as the Delta surged, the unvaccinated were 4.5 times more likely than the fully vaccinated to get infected, over 10 times more likely to be hospitalized, and 11 times more likely to die. And then to go along with that story, we have an opinion piece, which is headlined, Biden Finally Gets Tough with the Unvaccinated. And this is an opinion piece from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. President Joe Biden unleashed a political maelstrom last week by ordering tough new pandemic response measures, including a requirement that all large employers impose vaccine mandates or weekly testing on their workers. He was right to do it because, as he correctly stated, the patience of vaccinated Americans is wearing thin. Under the circumstances, such a mandate shouldn't even have been controversial. The fact that it is controversial demonstrates just how radically unreasonable the anti-science crowd has become. In addition to the vaccination or testing requirements covering businesses with more than 100 employees, Biden on Thursday announced that all federal workers will be required to be vaccinated, period, eliminating the previous opt-out option of weekly testing. He also ordered that all health facilities that accept Medicare or Medicaid require their staffs to be fully vaccinated. And he announced that federal transportation regulators will double fines for passengers who violate mask mandates on planes and trains. In a tough-talking speech that voiced the frustration that millions of responsible Americans are feeling today, Biden made clear that his administration is done coddling and coaxing the 80 million Americans who are prolonging the pandemic by refusing vaccination. About 200 million Americans are at least partially vaccinated, with virtually no serious adverse effects. The efficacy of the vaccines is undeniable at this point. The unvaccinated almost exclusively account for the patients filling hospital beds and morgues as the Delta variant surges around the nation, forcing new pandemic restrictions and dulling economic performance. The nation's patients is wearing thin, Biden said, and your refusal has cost all of us. Republican leaders around the country predictably lashed out at the new policies, vowing to sue and offering their usual misinterpretation of grocery responsibility as freedom. Businesses are already imposing all kinds of health mandates that haven't spawned this kind of pushback. Major businesses like Walmart, McDonald's, and Delta Airlines have had their own employee vaccine mandates in place for months. Many other businesses that may have wanted to impose such mandates but were worried about employee rebellion will undoubtedly welcome the new federal requirements. That may explain the remarkably muted response from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and other business groups that often reflexively oppose any new requirements on businesses. Biden has effectively thrown down a gauntlet, not against businesses and their employees, but against anti-science extremists who are worsening the pandemic and the politicians who pander to them. It's now up to Biden and his administration to defend these new measures and keep them in place. Lives depend on it. And again, this was an opinion piece from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, September 14th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. We'll now turn to today's obituaries. And our first one is Terrence C. Terry Taggart, 86, of Vermilion, passed away unexpectedly Saturday, September 11th at his residence. Funeral Mass will be 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, September 15th at St. Agnes Catholic Church in Vermilion. Burial will be at a later date. Visitation will begin at 5 p.m. on Tuesday, today, with a rosary followed by a prayer service at 7 p.m., all at the church. Arrangements are under the direction of Hanson Funeral Home of Vermilion. Terry was born February 2, 1935, in Sioux City, to Thomas and Gertrude Taggart. He graduated from Bishop Heelan High School in 1954 and graduated from Loras College in 1958 with his bachelor's degree in English and History. He attended graduate school at USD, served in the Marine Corps, and married Madeline Leonard on July 28, 1962 in Sioux City. Terry and Madeline moved to Vermilion in 1976 when they purchased Wimp's Restaurant until 1980, and in 1981 they purchased Bunyan's Bar in Vermilion, retiring in 2007. He had a house at the Missouri River since 1960, was an avid fisherman and duck hunter. While owning Wimp's and Bunyan's, Terry developed many great friendships with a lot of people. During his retirement, he served on the Clay County Conservation Board for many years, and was also president of the Clay County Park, and was very instrumental in the growth of the campground. He is survived by his wife Madeline of Vermilion, his two sons Thomas and Timothy of Vermilion, his daughter Tara of Invergrove Heights, Minnesota, his grandsons Travis, Jeff, Kyle, and Mason, granddaughters Sophia, Annalise, Elena, and Taryn, and great-granddaughters Addison and Peyton and Willow. Terry was preceded in death by his parents, his sisters and brothers-in-law Jane and Frank Sailors, Joan and Kenneth DeVries, and a brother and sister-in-law Thomas and Adie Taggart. In lieu of flowers, the family requests donations to the St. Agnes Catholic School. Arlene Caroline Berger of Sioux City, 94, died Saturday, September 11th. The service will be Friday, September 17th at 11 a.m. at the Holy Cross Michael Catholic Church. Burial will be at the Calvary Cemetery. Visitation will be September 17th from 9 to 11 a.m. with a rosary at 9 a.m. at the church. Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel are in charge of the arrangements. And that concludes obituaries for today. We'll now move to the sports section. And our top story in the sports section today is about the Sioux City Explorers. And the headline is, Sioux City Explorers season ends with postseason loss to Kansas City. Summer's end came faster than Sioux City wanted. The Sioux City Explorers season came to a close on Monday night in a disappointing fashion for the home crowd, with a lopsided 14-2 postseason loss to the Kansas City Monarchs at Lewis and Clark Park. Game 3 of the South Division Championship Series began in disastrous fashion for the Explorers, as the Monarchs scored 6 runs in the top of the first inning on 2 hits, 3 walks, and a hit batter. Exa starter Gerald LeBeau, a former Major League pitcher who was making his first start of the season for Sioux City, got the first out of the game on a flyout to center field from Monarch shortstop Morgan McCullough, but then walked Ryan Grosjean and hit Darnell Sweeney on the foot with a pitch. After getting right fielder Gabby Guerrero to pop out, Laborde hit Casey Gillespie to load the bases and then issued back-to-back bases-loaded walks to give Kansas City a 2-0 lead. Laborde then went to a 3-1 count on center fielder Paulo Orlando before allowing Orlando to hit a broken bat single to left field, which scored 2 runs and ended Laborde's day. Exa's manager Steve Montgomery pulled Laborde after 2/3 of an inning in favor of left-hander Tyler Koch, who immediately gave up a 2-run double to Kansas City catcher Alexis Almeida, giving the Monarchs a 6-0 lead. The inning ended just as it began, as McCullough flew out to center field for the final out of the frame. In the bottom of the first, Kansas City pitcher Justin Donatella retired the X's in order. The X's first baseman came in the second inning on a single from first baseman Seamus Curran, but the inning ended on the fielder's choice off the bat of Blake Tiberi, and the X's failed to score. Kansas City added 6 more runs in the third as the Monarchs knocked 6 singles in the inning to take a 12-0 lead. Sioux City got its first run in the bottom of the fourth inning. Second baseman Nick Franklin led it off with a walk, took second on a single from Curran, and scampered home on an RBI single to right from Sebastian Zawada. Third baseman Jose Zermel drove in the second run of the day for Sioux City with an RBI single in the fifth, scoring Michael Lang from second base. The hit was the final knock of the season for Zermel, who set the franchise's all-time career home run record earlier this season, along with the single-season home run record. "I think we're the better team, but they played the game the right way," Zermel said of Kansas City. "They're not better than us, but they played better than us. So that's why they're going to the finals and they're not, and we're not. I'm proud of what we did, even though we faced a lot of obstacles along the way, but those things that happen in life in general. Obviously, it's not the outcome we wanted, but we fought through the end." Kansas City scored its final runs of the game in the eighth inning on a 2-run home run from Sweeney, a shot that left the ballpark just below the left field scoreboard. Laborde was the game's losing pitcher after throwing 2/3 of an inning and giving up 6 earned runs, 1 hit, 3 walks, and a hit batter. Laborde spent most of the season on the Explorers' inactive list after experiencing difficulties acquiring a visa. And despite the rough outing, Sioux City manager Steve Montgomery didn't regret going to Laborde in a must-win game. "We wanted to get our eyeballs on him, to be honest," Montgomery said. "We wanted to know what we had, and it just didn't work out tonight. Maybe it was nerves, maybe he was trying to overthrow the ball. Whatever it was, it just didn't work out. That's not the reason we lost the game. Is it hard to come back from that situation? Obviously, but you win and lose as a team." Donatella got the win after throwing 6 innings and allowing 2 earned runs on 6 hits, 1 walk, while striking out 5 batters. Kansas City offense ended the night with 14 hits, while Sioux City had 7. With the loss, Kansas City earned a 3-game sweep in the best-of-5 series. "Obviously, we're disappointed," Montgomery said. "You never want to lose in that fashion or lose, period. But it was a fun 3 weeks of baseball that we played down the stretch. To get ourselves in this situation was a feat in itself." Sioux City ends its season with a 54-49 overall record, while Kansas City advances to the American Association Championship. Monarchs will play the winner of the North Division Championship Series between Chicago and Fargo-Moorhead. That series is currently tied 1-1. We'll now move to a couple of stories about college sports. The first one is college football. Headline is, "Johnson Wingert Earned Honors, Sioux City." It has been quite the successful week in the Austin Johnson and Tyler Wingert households. On Monday morning, the Great Plains Athletic Conference, or the GPAC, announced that the Morningside football seniors had been honored as a Conference's Offensive and Defensive Players of the Week. Johnson received the Offensive Player of the Week award after finishing with 8 catches for 261 yards and 2 touchdowns in the Mustangs' 56-14 win over Doan on Saturday, while Wingert received the defensive honors after racking up 11 tackles, 1.5 sacks, and an interception against the Tigers. It was a historic day for Johnson, whose 261 yards was the 9th highest single game yard total in program history. "It's a pretty cool accomplishment," Johnson said. "I think the crazy part is that I'm 9th with 261 yards. It just shows how many great receivers we've had here and the ritual we have of having a good wide receiver group at this school, the tradition." Johnson's award makes it the second consecutive week that a Morningside player took home the hardware after Mustangs quarterback Joe Dolinchek was named GPAC Player of the Week last Monday. On the other side of the field, Wingert, who is Johnson's roommate, earned his award after registering double-digit sacks for the third time in his career. "They're just all having great years," Morningside head coach Steve Ryan said. "Tyler has come out and had a great year so far, and usually you get the Player of the Week because you made plays during the game. Both of those guys made plays this past week." Wingert is currently tied for the team lead with 16 tackles and 3 sacks through 2 games, with 3 tackles for loss and 1 interception. He said that he doesn't know if he can best his 11 tackles from last week, but he has higher goals than just padding his own stats. "Stats-wise, I don't know if I can do that, but I always want to get better," Wingert says. "Just because I won an award doesn't mean that it's where the top is. I want to be better and get better every week. And our goal is not here. Our goal is to make it to the national championship." Morningside will host Mount Marty University on Saturday at Elwood Olsen Stadium. And also, staying with Morningside, we have a golf story. The Morningside University men's golf team put itself in second place after the first day of competition Monday at the Siouxland Invitational at the Ridge Golf Club. The Mustangs have 285 points, 5 behind team leader Iowa Western. Northwestern is third with an even score of 288 points, and Dort is fourth in 289. Northwestern's Trenton DeHaan leads the local pack with a 4-under-par score of 68. Morningside's Zan Milligan is fifth with a 69. Freddie Bullock of Dort has a 70, good for a 6th-place tie. Shane Hess leads Buena Vista with a 3-over score, good for 23rd. Ivan Yabut is the tournament leader. We'll now move to some high school sports stories, and these are just short briefs on various sports. We'll begin with the first one from golf. The Bishop Helan High School boys golf team took a triangular win on Monday at Whispering Creek Golf Course, winning the meet with 336 points. Lamar's was second with 351 points, and West was third with 493. Braden McCallick was the meet medalist as he recorded an 18-hole score of 83 points, of strokes, I mean. McCallick's front nine score was stronger by 1 stroke at a split of 41. Mason Streeter and Colin Koob tied for second, both shooting an 84. Jack White also shot an 85 for the Crusaders, while Shane Sanderson and Pierce Conley rounded out the team scorecard. Carter Baumgartner led the Bulldogs with 86 points. Dylan Seussmail and Cole Brownmiller both had scores of 88. Christian Lane led West with a score of 104. West Lyon Cross Country Invite. The Western Christian High School boys cross country team won the West Lyon Invitational on Monday with 17 points, taking 5 of the top 6 spots. Wolfpack senior Tage Holstein led the Wolfpack with a time on the Lake Pahoa 5,000 meter course with a time of 17 minutes and 40 seconds. Holstein won by a 63 second margin, beating the sophomore teammate Caleb Duma. Duma was a meet runner-up in 1843. Kaylin Hartbeck was third with a time of 1907. Boyden Hall Rock Valley Jr. Evan Jansen was the lone non-Wolfpack runner in the top 6. Jansen was fourth in 1909. Western Christian Jr. Noah DeWord was fifth, and Zachary Mitterhald was sixth. Lane Hendricks led George Little Rock Central Lions co-op squad with a seventh place time of 1936. Sam Meester led the Wildcats with an eighth place time of 1944. GLRCL was second with 64 points, while the Nighthawks were third with 66 points. Akron Westfield was also there, led by Dexter Briggs' 23rd place time of 21:33. Harris Lake Park was led by Landon Griff, as he had a 25th place time of 21:42. Tyler Kennedy led West Sioux in 28th. GLRCL took the first and second place spots during the girls' race. Mary Shriver won the meet in 21:44, while Afton Schlumball was second in 22:23. West Sioux's Mariah Berea was third at 22:39. Nighthawks freshman Elise Swart was fourth, while CLGLR's Cadence Boinder was fifth. Wildcats junior Gina Snyders was ninth, while Mava Havman was 10th, leading the Wolfpack. GLRCL won the meet with 23 points, while the home Wildcats were second with 76 points. And then we have just a score for some volleyball. Spencer 3, Sioux City 0. The Tigers swept the Rebels by set scores of 25-16, 25-15, and 25-11. We'll now move to a story about an event coming up for this coming weekend on Saturday. And it is a Nature Calls fundraiser for the Dorothy Peacock Nature Center. And it will start at 6 p.m. on Saturday, September 18th, with the live auction beginning at 9 p.m. And it's going to be at the Sioux City Convention Center. And so here's a story of a little bit of what's there. Oh, and then the tickets. It says here that this year only advance tickets will be sold. To purchase, you go to the Dorothy Peacock Nature Center at 4500 Sioux River Road, or you can go online at woodburyparks.org, or you can call 712-258-0838. And so this is a story about some of what there's going to be. How much would you pay for a rib bone of an Edmontosaurus dinosaur bone, or a festive wreath made out of deer antlers? Wait, are we playing The Price is Right? Sort of, since both of these items will be up for bid at the Dorothy Peacock Nature Center's Nature Calls fundraiser, taking place September 18th at the Sioux City Convention Center. We tried to include auction items a person could not get anywhere else, said Don Snyder, the Nature Center's Education Program Director. Artworks made of bones certainly qualify as offbeat gift items. Got any more? The auction will also have prints by the late wildlife artist Terry Redland. Pretty but conventional. A handcrafted cutting board made of black cherry and purple heart wood. Or individual paintings that were created by Riley Wex and Clarabel, the Nature Center's resident three-toed box turtles, and Oz and Mona, the Nature Center's ornate box turtles. We have a winner with turtle art. All right, you can certainly bid on less exciting stuff like hotel stays, fine jewelry, or more than 70 other live or silent auctions items. Plus, you can see the handiwork of area artisans and nature-themed vendors who will showcase off their best stuff. But we know many annual Nature Calls attendees enjoy the quirkier items, and the beer, of course. Our guests will be able to sample more than 60 craft beers, including some from local breweries, Snyder said. In addition, there will be IPAs, ciders, lagers, select wines, non-alcoholic beverages, and food items available throughout the evening. In fact, the blue jeans casual dress code of Nature Calls sets it apart from other nonprofit fundraisers. There's nothing stuffy about Nature Calls, Snyder said. It's just an evening of fun. Unfortunately, that was in short supply last year when Nature Calls was canceled due to COVID-19 concerns. We are happy to be back after a brief pause due to COVID, Snyder said. It is the Nature Center's only fundraising event, and it is vital to funding our programs. Indeed, Nature Calls has helped provide funding for such special programming as the Nature Center's indoor exhibits, the Raptor House, and the popular Discovery Forest Nature Playscape. This year, only advance tickets will be available. They may be purchased at the Dorothy Peacock Nature Center, online at woodburyparks.org, or by calling 712-258-0838. I know people look forward to the event because of the relaxed atmosphere and the unique combination of artists, beer, and auction items, Snyder said. They especially like that our goal is to raise funds for conservation education programs and exhibit. After all, Where else can you sample some quality craft brew while picking up your very own dinosaur bone? We now have a story under the title of Siouxland Strange. A South Dakota woman faces felony and misdemeanor charges after she led a high-speed sheriff's pursuit in Plymouth County while driving a vehicle stolen from Sioux City. At around 2:45 p.m. September 3rd, the Plymouth County Sheriff's Office was advised of a vehicle stolen from Sioux City that was reportedly in the area of County Road K-22 near County Road C-44, according to a press release from the Plymouth County Sheriff's Department. Deputies and Iowa State Patrol troopers responded and located the vehicle traveling east on Highway 3, about 5 miles west of Lamar's. Deputies attempted to pull the vehicle over, but the driver failed to stop and the pursuit ensued. The vehicle traveled through Lamar's on Highway 3 and continued east on 180th Street. The vehicle continued traveling through rural Plymouth County until it started east on County Road C-16 north of Remsen, according to the press release. Near the intersection of C-16 and Almond Avenue, the Iowa State Patrol used the pursuit intervention technique, according to the press release, and the vehicle ended up in the ditch. The driver, identified as 27-year-old Denise Sanchez of South Dakota, was taken into custody without further incident. Sanchez faces charges including possession of a stolen vehicle, a Class C felony, eluding while participating in a felony, a Class D felony, and operating while intoxicated, first offense, a serious misdemeanor. Numerous traffic charges will also be filed after the investigation is complete, the sheriff's office wrote in the press release. Speeds during the pursuit in the rural sections of the county reached approximately 112 miles per hour. The Plymouth County Sheriff's Office and the Iowa State Patrol were assisted by the Lamar's and Remsen Police Departments. We'll now move to Dear Abby. Dear Abby, I am currently without a job. I hesitated to inform my mother because I was sure her reaction would only add to my stress. I was right. She constantly corners me about my efforts to find a job. I talk to her nearly every day to keep up with how she and my stepfather are doing. Because she never fails to dig into me about my job search progress, I now find ways to shorten our conversations. I can get a job or two to sustain my living expenses for the time being. However, I'm trying to hold out for a job or career that connects to my sole passion. Working for decades in a job that sustains me and my children is no match for the longing of my passion. I'm still not sure what it is. How do I curb my mother's pushing me for a resolution without coming off as annoyed, which I am? I'm sure she wants to express her concern, but I want support in my efforts without feeling condemned. Help me, please. Signed, Annoyed in Alabama. And Abby responds, I will try. Because you still aren't sure what your sole passion is, it's time to find out. A place to start might be a career counseling center. Contact one or more and inquire whether they offer career counseling and aptitude testing. The test results will tell you what you are best suited for. Of course, this service is not offered for free, which is why you might want to buckle down and take a job or two in the meantime to afford it, as well as feed your little family. As to your mother, who may be worried because you don't yet have a plan of action, explain to her about seeking career counseling and she may calm down. And then our next letter is, Dear Abby, I've been seeing a man, Carson, on and off for about 5 years. Last year, when I asked him if we were exclusive, he quickly said no. So I went and slept with an ex and became pregnant. I didn't reach out to Carson because I thought the baby belonged to my ex, but when the baby was born, I quickly realized she might be Carson's. When I told him, he immediately denied she was his, but still rekindled our relationship. Abby, he disappears frequently and doesn't answer my calls. What should I do? Leave him? Stay? I do love him. Signed, Hopelessly Romantic in Pennsylvania. And Abby responds, Have your child DNA tested. If it proves she is Carson's, he should be contributing to his daughter's support. The same goes for anyone else you think could be the father. It is important that you understand this man behaves the way he does because he is not in love with you and doesn't care about your feelings. He sees other women just as he did the first time around. If this is the way you want to be treated, continue this relationship. If, however, you think you deserve something, anything better, end this poor excuse for a romance now. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, September 14th. I'm your reader, Dagna. and you can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you so much for listening.